Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, June 11th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. I'm here with my co-host, Ron Meniza. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch our recorded Facebook Live episode at FranStorchND for 30 days, and also my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So, let's see, my health update. The last time we talked, I was about to have an MRI to find out what's going on with my back. I am 1 week better than I was. I'm functioning more. I'm intending to return to work as normal. Of course, I'll have medicine and topicals and things like that. In terms of being about to have an MRI, I am still about to have an MRI. So some of you are going to be able to relate to this. My first try of my docs to get myself pre-approved for that MRI were denied. And so this will happen because a lot of times with MRIs, when you have a herniated disc, they want to see 6 weeks of physical therapy and anti-inflammatory medication. So it all depends on, I think, what doctor wrote it and how the doctor worded it, and also who they get on the other end. And we don't know if it's an algorithm or if it's a person or both. We don't know. But I did not meet the qualifications of the algorithm. And so at this moment, well, my insurance company is reviewing it. My doctors are going to do a peer-to-peer. And so at this moment, I have not heard back yet, which means that I haven't had the MRI done. I was off work last week, and that means I'm going to have to squeeze the MRI in somewhere, and it's going to affect work because I think they only do the MRIs in stores on days that I work. So anyway, so that's very frustrating. I am able to be upright and in much less pain. I am not completely pain-free. I am not taking pharmaceuticals right now of any kind. I might take them when I go back to work, and I probably will stick with acetaminophen because I don't feel well when I take NSAIDs, and I'm nervous to take the muscle relaxant because it makes me a little loopy. So I may not take those. I have found some good topicals, I must say. So the good topicals, your basic topicals are going to have a mixture of camphor and menthol in them. And, you know, they're sort of cooling and heating at the same time. They work as a counter irritant. You know, they do help with pain. And so I have a couple of those. I have a couple of different brands of those. You can also find stuff with camphor, menthol, and capsaicin in it, which is extract of cayenne pepper. So I may have something that has that. And then I have the topicals that have homeopathics in it, like arnica and hypericum and daisy and comfrey and stuff like that. So I have some topicals that do that. And then, of course, I have the topical magnesium spray that has frankincense oil in it, which is very helpful. And I have Epsom salt lotion. I recently took a float, which was lovely. While I am in the float, I am pain-free. But what's going on right now is when I am supine, I can be mostly pain-free. But if I spend time sitting or lying and then I stand up, it changes the position of probably the herniated disc or whatever's going on in there. And I get marked pain. And the pain is mostly in my left side, my lower left side, which is interesting. So I'm not sure where that's coming from, if it's coming from the upper lumbars or the lower thoracics. But an MRI would be able to tell us that. But if I stay mostly upright, I'm mostly okay throughout the day. And the less I do, the less active I am, the better. So the only physical activity I'm getting right now are special physical therapy exercises that include things like pelvic tilts and bridges and very gentle physical therapy exercises to strengthen my core, and also some restorative yoga. And that's all I'm doing. I'm not going for walks. I'm not on my bike. It's making me nuts because the weather has been lovely. My friends are all going on their bikes and I'm not going, and it's very sad. And I know how Ron feels because he's not on his bike either.
No.
So anyway, we're both kind of in limbo, although Ron will have his appointment with the neurologist this week. So that's not the neurologist, the spinal surgeon this week. Surgeon. So he's looking very much forward to that.
Moving forward here.
And he might get scheduled for surgery before too long, which will be exciting.
Yeah, really exciting.
Yeah.
Take my neck apart and put it back together again.
Well, you know what? If it takes away your problem, that will be worth it.
I'm ready.
And if I get an injection or surgery and it fixes my back, I'm okay with that too.
Right.
Because this is the third time that I've had this flare. I've been mostly out of commission for almost a month now. Mm. And that's a lot of time. And it was a lot of money because I wasn't able to work for a lot of that. So anyway, we're hoping to get around this and get on it. And hopefully we want to get back out there. We don't want to just not be in pain. We want to get back out there, as they say. Do you want to get back out there?
Oof, like yesterday?
Yeah. You want to get back out there yesterday? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
You know, I'm kind of missing my bike right now.
Oh, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah, my bike and I are kind of we're not having a breakup. We're just having a, you know.
You're taking some time off.
I'm taking some
time off. You're on a break. Like Ross and Rachel.
Right. We're having a little sabbatical.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't like sabbaticals.
Not from a bike.
Not from my bike.
No.
Yeah, my bike is, like, too important.
I know.
Like, I might not even be able to ride the Ride of Silence on Wednesday.
Yeah, me neither.
Because it's, I could probably do it, but.
You probably shouldn't, though.
Super careful.
Are you going to go?
Well, yeah, I'm going. I'm running. I'm helping Kevin run it. So, I'm definitely going.
I don't know if I'm going to go.
Promoting it like crazy, so.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm going to go. I can't ride it. I'm not riding it. But Yeah, that's too bad. So, given that recently my friend Randy had a birthday, so I wanted to shout out happy birthday to her. She's traveling in Portugal, which is so exciting. So I hope she's having fun there, riding her bike in Portugal and eating interesting Portuguese food, which probably includes a lot of fish and seafood and stuff. So excited for her, doing wonderful things. All right, so now let's get to some topics. What do you want to talk about? Did you know that pollen allergies are getting worse? So pollen allergies are getting worse, and that's a topic that's topical right now, because you're probably getting to that point where you go out to your car and you can write your name in your car, right? Because there's a yellow sheen over everything. So there's a lot of ways to, that plants tend to maintain themselves. So the pollen, in case you were wondering, is the male gametophyte of the plant kingdom. That's the male part of flowers. So you need pollen and you need the seed to come together, and then they make a full seed, and then they are able to reproduce the plant. So pollen is sort of the male part, and then there's an egg form that it meets up with. And when flowers pollinate, when pollinators pollinate, so like bees and other flies and other insects go about and pollinate, what they do is they take the nectar, they drink some of the nectar from the plant, and while they're doing it, they get pollen on them, and then they'll move to another flower, and they'll transfer the pollen to that other flower. And so you get a nice hybridization because because not every flower of the same species has exactly the same genetics. So they help to mix up the genetics, and they help to keep species growing. So they help diversify the species. So that's a very good thing. So that's why it's important to let your lawn go fallow, not to use pesticides on your lawn, and allow pollinators to come and get to flowers that will grow in the lawn, because we don't do anything to the lawn except mow it. And I make Ron mow around the flowers. We get, in our backyard, we get bluettes. I'm looking at our backyard. We get bluettes and we get violets, and we get cinquefoil, which are those little tiny five petaled yellow flowers that grow as a carpet. Sometimes we get wintergreen or snowberry, stuff like that in the lawn. And sometimes we get wild mints, and eventually we get daisies, and the daisies come in June. So the daisies will come. I think they're oxeye daisies. They're the great big daisies, not the. And we get little daisies too, and we get dandelions, of course, and we get the false dandelion, which I cannot remember what the false dandelion. It's not herbally. It's not polite to call a plant false whatever. It's polite to call it whatever its actual name is, and I can't remember what that is. So anyway, there's lots of pollen this time of year, and you know, everybody's going to the car wash, or people are washing their cars. Even people who aren't allergic to pollen can experience sneezing and watering eyes during the release of pollen in the spring, because it's just a physical irritant. You know, if you get something in your nose, if you inhale something in your nose, you're gonna sneeze. You may not be making allergic antibodies, but you are going to get some discomfort, and you might sneeze. So trees spread their pollen. So one way they spread the pollen is they employ an agent like a butterfly or a bee that can carry the pollen to another plant of the same species. And in order to entice animals to come and pollinate your tree, you have to have nice flowers. So the animals will be, you know, bees and butterflies are going to be attracted by pretty colors, and they're going to be attracted by pretty smells. So in order to do that, and you have to have a nice nectar to offer them, and then they're going to show up, and they're going to take some of the nectar, and then they'll get the pollen on their tuchus, and they'll distribute it to another flower. And the other thing is you can get a free ride on the wind. When the wind blows, you know, I've seen a wind gust come up and a tree sort of explode with yellow powder coming out of it. That's always exciting when that happens. It was the original pollinator long before animal mediated pollination, and wind doesn't need a showy flower or nectar. It just requires little pollen, you know, small lightweight pollen that will be carried on the wind. So windblown pollen makes your allergies worse. It's not efficient. The probability of one pollen grain landing in the right spot, which is the stigma or ovule of another plant of the same species, is infinitesimally small. So wind pollinated trees have to compensate for the inefficiency by producing lots and lots and lots of pollen, and it has to be light enough to be carried. So if you suffer from allergies, that can mean air filled with microscopic pollen can get into your eyes, throat, and lungs, sneak in through window screens because it's small enough to do that, and convince your immune system that you've inhaled a dangerous intruder. No fun, right? So plants that rely on animal-mediated pollen can produce heavier and stickier pollen and adhere to the body of an insect. Bees are not going to make your allergies worse. It is the wind, and it's the little tiny bits of pollen. So climate change does have a role as well. Plants initiate pollen release based on a few factors like temperature and light cues. The temperate tree species will respond to cues that signal the beginning of spring, like warmer temperatures. And studies have found that pollen seasons intensified in the past three decades as the climate has warmed. One study showed that about 60 locations in the United States found pollen seasons expanded by an average of 20 days between 1990 and 2018, and pollen concentrations literally increased by 21%. When you have more carbon dioxide in the air, that also increases the quantity of tree pollen, probably because carbon dioxide feeds tree, you know, that's what plants breathe. We breathe oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. They breathe in carbon dioxide and send out oxygen, which is very nice. But when you have more carbon dioxide, they're going to be that much more enriched in what they need to thrive, and they're going to produce more pollen. So the Southeast gets really socked. That's the worst place for pollen. The southeastern U.S., you have strong wind storms. They're becoming more common and more intense, and not just hurricanes. If you've lived in the Southeast for the past couple decades, you might have noticed that. It's especially true in the Mid-South. That's Mississippi, particularly Mississippi and Alabama. So since wind, and the thing with Mississippi and Alabama is a lot of the state is inland. They have little, the beach section. Whereas if you're in Florida, you're on a peninsula. And Florida, if you look at the pollen map, I have a pollen map in front of me. And the pollen map is awful the further north that you get in both Mississippi and Alabama. when you look at the pollen map for Florida, it's not that bad. It's the worst in Central Florida, probably because Central Florida, like right in the middle of Florida and inland, there's a dot where the pollen is the worst. And everywhere else, north and south in the panhandle, it's not that bad. That's because Florida's a peninsula. It gets a lot of wind blowing through. So, and the winds are strong enough to blow the pollen away, so it doesn't affect you as much. You don't have as many, you know, classic deciduous trees. You have palms. So a lot, when you go to Florida, the pollen that you see is pretty much cedar and juniper and not much else. What you're seeing in Central Florida is where the concentration of population is. That's where you have Orlando and everything having to do with Orlando around it. And I think it leans into Tampa. Tampa, again, is on the coast and is not as bad as what I'm looking at is Greater Orlando. That's where the worst pollen is in Florida. And it's a big city, so they have more carbon dioxide because they have more pollution. So, and they have a lot of trees planted, and they probably have a more variety of trees planted because it's a planned community. So they have more pollen in Central Florida. When you get down to Venice by my mother, it's not so bad. I'm looking at where Venice is. It's not a big deal. Sarasota, and once you get south, and the peninsula is very, there's not a lot of pollen. But when you get into the further north you get in Alabama and Mississippi, the worse it gets. They have a lot of heat there. It gets very hot there, and you have a lot of light, you know, a lot of time of the year where it's light, and it's the heat, the hot season is longer than it is here. And so they're going to get, they really get slammed. So wind is the vector of airborne pollen. Windier conditions can make allergies. And then, like we're saying, they have a lot of wind. So you have this perfect storm of heat, wind, inland, and light. And that makes it the worst up there. So increasing storm activity, maybe doing more than just transporting pollen, it can break apart the pollen grains, which create even smaller particles that can penetrate deeper into the lungs. Oy vey. So allergy sufferers may notice worsening allergies during storms. Now, we notice the pollen count goes down here when it rains because it washes the pollen out of the air. But we don't have as many dramatic storms as they do in that location. So the peak of spring wind and storm season tends to correspond to the timing of the release of tree pollen, and it makes the world yellow. The effects of climate change, including longer pollen seasons and more pollen released, and corresponding shifts in windy days and storm severity help to create the perfect pollen storm. So that's what's going on with all that pollen. So if you're suffering from extra allergens, you know, there's stuff that maybe you want to do about that, and I'll just review that quickly. Again, when you come inside from outside, you may want to wash, and if you may want to wash your hair more frequently because pollen will stick in your hair. Wash your clothes more frequently if you've been outside because the pollen will stick to your clothes as well. If you can use a neti pot, that's a great thing to use. Neti pots are really great for flushing out your nose and flushing out any particles. If you're making antibodies to the pollen, you're going to flush them out as well. So, and salt water, that's a little more than physiological saline. So one rule of thumb is 1 cup water to half a teaspoon of sea salt. And you can use sea salt. I use the real salt, you know, the salt from pink salt from Utah. You can use finely granulated Himalayan salt. It's fine. But sea salt's better because you're going to have less, it's more easily dissolved. You can get, sometimes your neti pot will come with packets that have salt and bicarbonate in it. I don't prefer the bicarbonate. It irritates my nose, but if you like it, that's no problem. And, you know, your neti pot, the packets will be set up so it's the right quantity for whatever size neti pot you've purchased. And so you want your water to be lukewarm. You don't want it to be too hot because it'll burn your nose, and you don't want it to be cold because it'll make you dizzy. And so you want it to be just right in the Goldilocks zone. And if you have a very deep well, you can just use tap water. Or if you have city water, you can just use tap water. If you do not, if you have a shallow well, like your well is 17 feet or 20 feet deep, you need to boil your water first. And then, of course, let it cool and make sure that it's a temperature that's going to be comfortable for you. And you may have to warm it a little bit. And you can use it. And also, if you are concerned at all about getting any microorganisms in your nose, then you can use distilled water. And distilled water is not going to have any microorganisms in it, but you have to gently heat it to a level that works for you for your neti pot. So using your neti pot is a good idea. And then there's things you can take if you absolutely must take pharmaceutical. You can get over-the-counter stuff. Your doctor can prescribe stuff for you. You can get different antihistamines. Remember that stuff like diphenhydramine is going to make you tired. And you have to experiment with the different other over-the-counter antihistamines like loratadine, desloratadine, and fexofenadine. Those are the, I'm trying not to say the brand names. Generally, those three don't tend to make you as tired. Diphenhydramine is used as a sleep aid, so that's going to make you tired. And one of the things that's happening is when you get an allergy symptom, you are increasing your immune globulin E, and immune globulin E causes you to release histamine, and histamine gives you the symptoms. It gives you the inflammation, the watery eyes, the runny nose, the itching. And when you block histamine, then you're going to be less likely to have those symptoms. And there's definitely stuff you can take naturally. So shout out to Craig, who is using a blend of lemon, lavender, and peppermint for allergies in a soft gel that he's actually taking, and that's helpful for him. And Craig mentions that the panhandle in Florida is actually tough in the spring, even though it didn't look like it on the map. I'll take his word for it if he's been to the panhandle. I don't think I've ever been to the Florida panhandle. I have been as far north as Tampa and Orlando, and that's it. I've been to the Keys. So that's as far south as I've gone. That's about it in Florida. That's the furthest south point on the I-95 and also Route 1. So I've been there too. There's certainly natural medicine things that you can take. And nettles and eyebright are my two favorites. And if you can get yourself to drink nettle tea, that's really helpful. Nettle leaf is lovely. It's very benign, and you can drink it all day. And it's very nutritious. It has a lot of vitamins and minerals in it. And it also has constituents that reduce histamine production. And eyebright helps too, especially if you have eye symptoms. And you take it internally. You can get, if you have itchy eyes, you can get eyebright tea bags and dip them in warm water and then relax and put the eyebright tea bags over your eyes. And the flavonoids will help to reduce inflammation in your eyes. And you can also use black tea bags. Black tea bags have tannins in them, so it's nice to get organic and rinse them. Again, rinse them in warm water and then lie down, put them on your eyes, and the tannins will reduce puffiness and the itchy components that are giving you problems in your eyes. So that's another thing you can do. You can take eyebright nettles in pills. I have a compound that has eyebright nettles, horseradish, and elderberry, and that helps too. Extra vitamin C can be helpful, and of course, you drink lemon in your water. That's a great way to get vitamin C in. You know, drinking lemon water first thing in the morning is a great time of year to do that because you get a natural form of vitamin C, bioflavonoids, and it helps to clear mucus. The citric acid, well, it helps to break up mucus and clear it out, so that's nice too. And you can take extra vitamin C. You can take extra vitamin C with bioflavonoids. That's helpful to do. Bromelain is also helpful. Bromelain is extract of pineapple. And most of the bromelain, you can eat pineapple this time of year. Now, it's not, pineapple obviously doesn't grow here, but if you can get a pineapple that's reasonably fresh, and you can buy a pineapple at the store, if it's not ripe, you can let it ripen on your counter for a couple of days. Most of the bromelain is actually in the stem of the pineapple. That's where it's mostly extracted from when you get bromelain in pills. But what it is a proteolytic enzyme. It breaks down proteins, so it breaks down the inflammatory proteins that are created by you having your allergic symptoms. And it breaks down the proteins that are in mucus, so it's a good mucolytic. And if you have a lot of mucus as well, N-acetylcysteine can help, NAC. That's a great mucolytic as well. And so the other thing that's really helpful for allergies is this rare and precious substance, right? Yeah, so I'm showing you on the video a glass of water that when you're making a lot of mucus, you're losing water and you're getting dehydrated, so you need to replace it with fresh water. And when you drink water, you will thin your mucus. The mucus itself will be thinner because it's you're diluting it by drinking water. So hydrating well is a really good idea. Hydrating with lemon or lime, even better. And you can use lemon or lime, whatever you take, you know, you can mix it up. Either they will both do the same thing. Probably grapefruit too. You can squeeze a little grapefruit into your water if you'd like to do that. So there's lots of things that you can do. Getting adequate rest, you might find if you rest. And then when you're in your house, you may want to be running a HEPA filter or run the air conditioner, especially if the air conditioner has a filter on it, and that will help to filter out the extra pollen and any dust and mold that's in your house. And the other thing is eating really healthy. Eating your fruits and vegetables is particularly important this time of year because you're going to get your vitamin C, your bioflavonoids, all kinds of vitamins and minerals and fiber, which is going to set up a good microbiome. If you have the right microbiome, you're going to have less inflammation and less allergic reactions. If you eat too many inflammatory foods like junk food, too much barbecue food, I don't mean barbecue. If it's healthy barbecue, like if you grilled some chicken with some healthy barbecue sauce, that's not the same as eating just a whole bunch of junk, like going to fast food and that sort of thing. That if you eat fruits and vegetables and clean protein and stay away from too much alcohol, which dehydrates you and taxes the resources of your liver. And also if you eat too much starch and sugar is going to cause more inflammation and more mucus, and you're going to likely have more symptoms. So eating healthfully really is helpful as well. And then getting regular exercise, even though you have to go outside, if you go outside and get the exercise, even though you're exercising outside, if you have allergies, you'll ultimately feel better. The thing to do is to go outside, get the exercise, come back in, and then, you know, clear your nose. I didn't mention gargling. After you use a neti pot, it's a really good idea to gargle because some of the pollen, when you breathe, sometimes you breathe with an open mouth and some of the pollen's going to get into your throat. So if you gargle, you're going to get some of that excess out. And when you use the neti pot, some of what you are pouring down your nose is going to drip into the back of your throat. So you'll catch that if you gargle. And so I'm a fan of cleaning my nose and then gargling. What can go in the nose? So if you're not a big neti potter, there are other things that you can do. You can take, remember Craig was talking about essential oils. So you can put a drop of essential oil on a cotton swab, dip it in warm water with a little bit of salt. Whenever you put anything in your nose, it should have a little bit of salt in it. Otherwise, you have that osmotic issue where you're going to, remember that water, the law of osmosis is that that fluid will travel from an area of low concentration to high concentration across a semipermeable membrane. The semipermeable membrane is your mucous membrane in your nose or your throat. And if you put plain water into your nose or throat, the water is going to go into your mucous membrane because it's the higher concentration is the inside of your is the other side of your mucous membranes. That's why when water gets into your nose, you feel like you're drowning. If you get water up your nose in the ocean, you don't have that osmotic effect. You have a direct burning effect because it's a really high concentration of salt. Having said that, there are people who live by the ocean or sailors who would grab salt water. One of their, you know, their morning rituals is to go to the edge of the water, get some salt water and snort some of it up to clear their nose. Why? Because it kills everything. The salt will kill microorganisms. Remember, you're going to have more allergy symptoms if you have stuff growing in your nose. And if you clean your nose regularly, you'll have less stuff growing in your nose. It is normal. Everybody has mold growing in their nose. Ron, you have mold growing in your nose. You do. But so do I. So do you. Whoever you are listening, if you are a human, you have, if you have a nose, there's mold in there. So if you...
I have a nose.
Oh, boy, do you have a nose. So if you... So if you clear the mold that's in there, there's mold and bacteria and maybe even viruses that tend to hang out in your nose because it's a warm, moist environment. So if you clean your nose regularly, you'll have less of that going on. So you're going to have less overall inflammation. So you're going to be less symptomatic. So Ron has worse respiratory allergies than I do. That's just genetically, he was blessed that way. Not sure why he's, it's really, I think it's genetic because we're exposed to all the same stuff. We eat a lot of the same stuff. We're exposed to the same pollen outdoors and the same mold and dust indoors. I'm definitely allergic to dust and mold. I don't have as much, I don't know if I have a, I don't have much in the way of a pollen allergy.
My sister and I both do.
Yeah, you do. Like really intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not that bad. Having said that, like it said in the article, I'm one of those people that if you can see the pollen floating through the air, or, you know, you have one of those wind gusts and you can see the tree and it blows the tree and you see this big yellow cloud come. Have you seen that before?
Oh, yeah.
The big yellow cloud coming out of the tree. Have you ever written your name or I love you, Fran, on your car?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
Yeah, right. I've written wash me and people's cars. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is the time of year that you get a sheen.
Yeah, I see that and I go running for a respirator.
Have you seen a sheen on your car yet this year?
A sheen? Yeah.
Sheen of yellow pollen that you could write your name
in.
It's
happening right now.
Yeah. So we tend to keep our cars in the garage now, so that mitigates that a bit. But, if we go somewhere, like if we park at the office, you know, trees near my office, they're going to... Mm. Sometimes I park under a tree, so...
And there's all sorts of interesting things coming off the trees right now.
We have the oak flowers.
Yeah, the oak flower, those long stringy things.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are coming down, and then the maples are sending a little seed.
The helicopters.
The little helicopters.
Right. Yeah, I had an oak flower. I went to the bathroom, and I saw an oak flower in the toilet. How did it get there?
You never know. They get everywhere.
Yeah, I think I was sitting in the gravity chair. By the way, that gravity chair is a lifesaver. I really recommend them. If you have any back issues and you want to sit outside, get a gravity chair. So if you're not sure what that is, it's a lounge chair. It's a chaise lounge where you are able to sit with your whole body. Your legs are propped up and it has a curve. So it supports your lower back and you can lean back in the chair and your legs will be, your thighs will be on an angle and your legs will be horizontal, perpendicular to the ground, not perpendicular, parallel with the ground. And for me, with my herniated disc, it's a very nice way to sit and it's a way for me to sit outside and it's very nice. So we've been doing a bit of that because we broke out the gravity chairs and they're nice to sit in. It's a little hard to have a snack in the gravity chair. You kind of have to sit up to do that. But to sit and read a book or sit and listen to the birds and watch all the birds, it's a nice thing. Boy, have we seen a lot of birds. That's been fun. Yeah. So
have you seen these?
So I use the... Oh, wow. So Ron is looking at some gravity chairs for inside your home.
Yeah.
So do they have massage and other features in them?
I don't think this one does. It's just a foam.
That's a foam.
Chaise lounge.
Yeah, that for indoors. Yeah, is it just, it's just foam?
Yeah, I think so. Not sure 100%.
I don't know.
I have to look it up.
I don't know where we would put that if we... We don't have a space for it. Because what I did was I got a wedge. I saw that recommended by a physical therapist online. I got a wedge bolster.
You can also do like this type of thing too. So.
Well, that's a gravity chair. We have that. But it's cushioned.
Yeah, but this is all cushioned.
That's nice. It's a cushioned gravity chair.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Yep.
And then I have a beanbag chair in my office, which is helpful for when my back's pretty sore. Okay, so anyway, so all those things could be helpful for your pollen allergies. All right, so the next topic is if you are vegan, you have to take care to make sure you get enough protein in your diet. And if you eat vegan, you may have a hard time getting certain amino acids. So let's see what it says. Because this is a current concern of mine. I have people come in who say that they're vegan and there's all kinds of ways to be vegan. You can eat, you can go to fast food and have French fries and a bun that has, you know, the sauce and lettuce and tomato on it and no cheese. And that's vegan, you know, and you can have a cola with that and you're vegan. But that's not a healthy way to eat. So vegans who meet their daily protein requirements can still, even if you're getting enough protein, you might not get certain essential amino acids. And remember, you know what the amino acids are? The essential amino acids. There's 9 of them.
Yeah.
Three liars, Val, Lucy, and me, tripped and fell over his isolation tank.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's a mnemonic for the amino acids. Threonine, lysine, valine, leucine, and methionine, tryptophan, and phenylalanine over histidine, isoleucine, tyrosine. See, so that's a great mnemonic, if you can remember it. Three liars, Val, Lucy, and me, tripped and fell over his isolation tank. And that's a good mnemonic for remembering the nine essential amino acids. All right, so, and you might not be getting all of them. So that protein quality is important, not just quantity, because you can get enough protein, but you can get complete proteins, but they might not be complete proteins. And you can get amino acids, but you might not be getting all the amino acids. And protein is made up of amino acids. The protein has quaternary structure. The lowest level of structure is the amino acid. Then the amino acids are hooked together as peptides, and the peptides hook together as polypeptides. And then the polypeptides have a conformation in space. So I believe you can have two proteins, but if they have different conformations, they are not the same compound. That's generally a thing in organic chemistry. You can have something with the same empirical formula, but it's a different compound based on how it's arranged in space. So protein quality is just as important as protein quantity, and animal-based proteins have all the nine amino acids. Many plant proteins are less digestible and so may have lower concentrations of one or more essential amino acids. And when you eat them, you might not be able to absorb them. So there are certain amino acids you might not be getting. Prior studies have tended to focus on the amount of protein. There's a new study that was published recently that said that there's specific amino acids that they may not be getting. When you think about digestibility, the research found that only about half the participants met the body's requirements for lysine and leucine. And so lysine is really important for wound healing, for hair, skin, and nails. And leucine is really important. It's one of the branched chain amino acids, and it's one of the amino acids that you need for muscle building. So if you are having trouble building muscle as a vegan, it may be because one reason could be because you're not getting enough leucine. So you have to evaluate your quality of protein and the amino acid composition. And amino acids, as we said, are the building blocks of protein. So the body can produce some amino acids on its own. There are nine essential amino acids that come from your dietary sources. And I already said what they were. Plant-based proteins used to be thought of as incomplete proteins because they lack certain essential amino acids. They actually provide all nine essential amino acids, but sometimes in less optimal levels than animal-based foods. So those following a vegan diet may consume a strategic variety and quantity of foods like nuts and legumes to get enough of the essential amino acids. So if you consume 30 grams of lower quality plant protein, like wheat, is different from consuming the same quality of protein from soy, which is a higher quality plant protein, one of the researchers said. So they find that while we're meeting total protein requirements, the foods consumed may not be of adequate protein quality and supply enough lysine and leucine that you need for your bodily functions. And in this study, the study that was done, they studied 193 long-term vegans in New Zealand, and they were healthy adults who'd followed a vegan diet for at least 2 years, and they completed a four-day food diary, and they documented all their food, beverage, and supplements over consecutive days, and they adjusted for protein digestibility, which is how well the body breaks down the proteins and absorbs them. And after adjusting for digestibility, they found that while most participants met their overall protein requirements, that is, they got enough protein for the day, many fell short on specifically lysine and leucine. So soy protein has one of the highest digestibility ratings among plant foods. Having said that, there are a lot of people who don't digest it easily. I am a lucky person because I can digest soy protein. So I will have tempeh tofu or edamame roasted or fresh or, steamed. So I can digest protein, but not everybody can. So soy protein allows the body to utilize nearly all of its nutrient contrast, and wheat protein has lower digestibility rates, and so many people have problems digesting wheat, right? And there's presence of anti-nutrients and other factors like wheat germ, agglutinin, and then people have issues with gluten, stuff like that, and then FODMAPs. The distinction is crucial because a lot of assessments of plant-based diets may overestimate actual protein availability by not accounting for digestibility, which they found in the study. After adjusting for that, 25% of participants didn't meet their protein requirements, more pronounced for specific amino acids. Less than half met their requirements for digestible leucine, and just 56% consumed adequate digestible lysine. The remaining essential amino acids were generally present in sufficient amounts, even after the digestibility assessment. So what are the 9 essential amino acids? They are. They don't put them in the order that I said them. It says phenylalanine, valine, threonine, tryptophan, methionine, leucine, isoleucine, lysine, and histidine. Three liars, Val, Lucy, and me, tripped and fell over his isolation tank. So the body can't synthesize amino acids on its own. You can't synthesize essential. That's actually, if you know what you're talking about, that's redundant. When you say you can't synthesize something that's essential, that's the definition of essential. If a nutrient is essential, it means you can't synthesize it. That's what it means. You have to eat a well-balanced diet, especially when you're following a vegan diet. You need essential amino acids for health in general. So if you have an ongoing deficiency, that's going to create health issues. So the 9 essential amino acids do a lot of functions. They stimulate muscle growth. They help you with fat metabolism. That's why when we're talking to people about eating a diet that's going to help them with fat loss, we talk about eating protein, 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 protein. It helps with immune function. You need immune compounds. Antibodies require amino acids for their structure. Sleep regulation. When you take amino acids like tryptophan, that's a precursor to serotonin, which you need for adequate sleep. Appetite control. Again, dopamine and serotonin are involved in appetite control, and then the precursor to dopamine is tyrosine. Precursor to serotonin is tryptophan. They help to regulate blood sugar. Once again, the biggies are tyrosine, phenylalanine, and tryptophan. And then they help with calcium absorption. So if you don't get adequate protein, you people with bone density issues, if you have osteoporosis or osteopenia, you need to, what I tell my people with osteoporosis and osteopenia, you need protein, and you need protein for the structure, for the collagenous structure of the bones, but you also need it to assist in absorbing the calcium that you need for your bones. So lysine and leucine contribute to bone health, healthy muscle mass, and DNA methylation. So when we make people take branched chain amino acids, those are the biggies for building muscle. It's leucine, isoleucine, and I believe valine, but you need lysine too, apparently. And so you need that for DNA methylation too. Leucine has particular important roles in signaling pathways that modulate muscle production. So to eat a nutritious vegan diet, you have to eat diverse plant proteins, and you have to eat them in the 3 meals of the day and supplement with 1 or 2 protein-dense snacks like nuts and seeds and protein shakes. And if you're falling short of your protein goals, that's where a protein shake can come in. And, you know, you have to find a vegan protein that you're going to dissolve. I like to recommend yellow pea protein. There are proteins that you can get. There's rice protein, yellow pea protein. There are protein mixtures where the proteins come from grains and legumes. And they're concentrated protein. And, you know, so if you're not making your protein goals with just food, it's okay to supplement with a protein powder if you need to do that. The legumes and pulses like edamame, black beans, chickpeas, and lentils are great sources of digestible protein and also lysine. And not everybody eats beans. And if you're a vegan, eating legumes is important. And some people say, well, I'm vegan, but I can't eat beans. I'm like, whoa, oh, that's rough. And then this is when I start questioning people and saying, do you want to eat some animal protein? And some say no, and some say yes. So I do my best to support them wherever they're at. So you're going to still get some protein and amino acids from fruits, vegetables, grains, and non-dairy milk, all of which can contribute to your amino acid intake. when you're hitting the adequate protein amounts, you want to have a well-balanced diet that has fiber and other nutrients. Other animal-derived proteins, which have all 9 essential amino acids in adequate amounts, plant proteins need to be combined to reach the same nutritional benchmark. But you don't have to combine specific foods at every meal. Consuming various plant-based proteins through the day and emphasizing high-quality plant protein sources like beans and soy products, if you tolerate them, can help you meet your needs for essential amino acids. And you have to examine the diet as a whole, not focusing on individual parts. You don't need to target lysine or leucine or even any other specific amino acids. Just focusing on high fiber and protein plant-based foods should help achieve discrepancies in amino acids. So if you follow a vegan diet that doesn't automatically guarantee balanced nutrition, you have to be intentional about your food choices. Some docs see that their vegan patients start on their own and made choices that didn't always speak to good nutrition. They may have been eating ultra-processed vegan foods, not focusing on nutrient density, because you can get vegan foods. You can get fake cheese, which I use fake cheese for its for the taste and texture. I don't eat it because I think it's particularly nutritious. I eat it because I miss cheese and it gives me the mouthfeel, and I don't eat a lot of it. So if I have a great big salad, I'm going to have a few little cubes of vegan cheese. If I'm having a sandwich, I'm not going to feature the cheese on the sandwich. I'm going to have half a slice of cheese, and I'm not a vegan, so I'm going to have half a slice of cheese on my turkey sandwich just for the taste and the texture. But I don't rely on it as a healthy food source. And in terms of non-dairy milk substitutes, that, again, that's really for, it's more for, because it tastes good. So I'm going to put a non-dairy creamer in my coffee. I'm going to put a non-dairy creamer in my chai, or non-dairy milk in my chai. When I make my protein shake, I use a non-dairy milk for that, just because it's more interesting and flavorful with the creaminess and the fat than it is with just plain water. So, but I won't sit and have a glass of milk, and I won't rely on, like, most of the time I would not have a vegan grilled cheese sandwich unless I went to a restaurant and somebody was making a really good one. Ron does make a mean, vegan, well, not vegan, non-dairy pizza, gluten and dairy free pizza, that we use vegan cheese for. So, again, the cheese is for the mouthfeel and for the interest, and we don't have it every day. And we have animal protein on that on the pizza as well. We had that last night; it was very good. Mm. So, yeah, Ron likes to make pizza, which is great. So there you go. So, if you are vegan, it is very important to look at the quality of the protein that you're eating and make sure that your diet should look like you're eating a decent amount of fruits and vegetables. Nuts and seeds, if you tolerate them, whole grains, and not to have mostly whole grains as your diet, but also to eat things like beans and legumes, like lentils and soy if you tolerate it. And my favorite soys are the least processed soy. So edamame, toasted edamame, and tempeh. Tempeh is just fermented soybeans. And so you're going to get probiotics with that. Fermentation of the soybeans is going to bring forth more B vitamins and other nutrients that are created in the process of fermentation. And you're going to get a decent amount of protein when you eat that. So if you're not, and then some people are soy intolerant. So obviously if you can't eat soy, then you're not going to eat it. But if you can find ways to, if you're vegan and you can find ways to healthfully eat beans, there are ways to make legumes more digestible. One of them is whether you start from dried beans or you start from beans in a can, soaking and rinsing is a really good idea. And for dried beans, you want to soak for a good at least 24 hours. And if you happen to be home while the soaking is happening, you want to change the soak water every few hours. So maybe, you soak it and you put in, I like to put in a pinch of baking soda. Baking soda will help to take out the, help to break down some of those galactoses, some of those fructans that are, that cause digestive upset, the starches, the heavy starches that are in the skin of the beans. And so if you soak them, it breaks them down. And if you put in baking soda, that helps. And then if you put in carminative herbs, like so many culinary herbs are carminative. Carminative meaning that they help to push things along to keep gas out of your system. So cinnamon and ginger and oregano and marjoram and thyme and curcumin and turmeric and cumin and coriander, they're all carminative, and all those herbs are helpful. So if you put in herbs and spices in your beans, it's going to help. Anise and fennel as well. They all help with reducing the gassiness of the beans. But the big thing is soaking, and I especially encourage a pinch of baking soda. Let it soak for 3 or 4 hours, and then change the soak water and start over. Rinse them and start over, and do that throughout the day. Let them soak overnight and then cook them. If you get canned beans, they're already cooked, then I would say just make sure you rinse them really well. If you have time to soak them, you can do that. And again, add your pinch of baking soda. And another thing to do would be if you rinse them and then you're going to eat them as part of your meal, when you're cooking them, like when you give us beans for our Mexican bowls, do you cook the beans?
No.
Ah.
They're already cooked. They're canned.
So you should rinse them.
I do.
When you rinse them, then put a pinch of baking afterwards. Put a pinch of baking soda in and stir it in. Makes them less gassy.
But you never have problems with the beans.
I don't. Do you?
No.
All right. So
that's
because
I rinse them.
Maybe because I think I just don't have problems with beans. I'm a lucky person that I don't.
I just rinse them a lot.
Yeah.
That's
good.
I run them through a couple times.
So. The other thing is, the more you eat beans, because what helps you to be able to eat beans is we can't digest those stachyoses and those other oses that are part of the beans, because we don't have cellulases. We don't have enzymes that break down cellulose in our system. So when you are able to eat beans and you don't particularly get extra gas from them, it's because you've developed a microbiome that allows for that. And not everybody is able to do that. Like, if no matter what you do, no matter if you soak, salt, rinse, cook for 2 days in a crock pot, that's the other thing. If you are going to cook them, if you're starting from dried and you want to cook them yourself, then you cook them, you do long, slow cooking, and that can help too. Some people, that doesn't work either. So no matter what they do, you know, and you can try taking the enzymes. You can have enzymes that have fructases and galactosidases in them. And if that may work for you. And if it doesn't, you may just not be able to eat beans without getting a lot of gas, in which case you may want to rethink whether you really want to be a vegan. Or whether you really want to eat beans. And if you can manage to get your proteins in other ways, such as, like maybe there are some beans that work for you and some beans that don't, that can happen too, that smaller beans tend to be more digestible. So lentils tend to be more digestible than great big kidney beans. But again, it depends on the person. So you can try different beans to see if they're ones you tolerate more than others. So long, slow cooking is key, because that helps to break down those galactoses and the other long chain starches that we can't break down. You may find that over time, if you continue to eat them, you'll develop a microbiome that it's the microbiome that's actually helping, once it gets into your gut, to break down those starches in the beans. So I have a vegetarian-friendly microbiome, and I guess Ron relatively does too. And it may be because we just eat a lot of produce, and we regularly eat a lot of produce. We're big salad eaters. We're big stir-fry and soup eaters. And so we have a lot of vegetables, and we have veggies and fruit in our diet every single day. So if you don't do that, if you're, you know, eating a lot of fast food, or you're eating a lot of, like, you know, bread and cheese or you know, peanut butter sandwiches, and you're not eating vegetables regularly, you're not going to develop vegetable or, you know, plant protein or plant-based diet friendly microbiome, and you need to develop that. And again, you can take enzymes that can help with that, and you can take probiotics that can help with that. So there you go. So let's see, that was protein in your vegan diets. Here's some food sources of leucine. So there are 10 foods that are high in, here's 10 foods that are high in leucine. Leucine is one of those branched chain amino acids like valine and isoleucine, is important for building muscle. So if you want to get some extra leucine in your diet, here's some ways to get them. Canned navy beans have them. They have protein, fiber, and micronutrients like folate and other B vitamins. Navy beans helps to prevent protect heart health and improve your metabolic risk factors. They also have phosphatidylserine, which is a fatty compound that helps your, I actually take phosphatidylserine as a supplement, helps brain health like memory, focus, and protein and problem solving. I'm taking the phosphatidylserine to help heal my nerves. Cottage cheese, if you are not dairy intolerant, cottage cheese is a good source of leucine. Also protein, vitamin B12, and selenium. With its high protein content, if you eat cottage cheese, it can help support weight loss, helps you to feel full for longer. It can help you to gain muscle mass if you combine it with resistance training. You can have it with berries and nuts for a good breakfast. I used to enjoy cottage cheese. I found over time that I just didn't digest it very well. And we'll give you one more, and that's sesame seeds. 2 tablespoons of whole dried sesames has 0.25 grams of leucine. So it's not a lot of leucine. But it's some, and they're a good source of fiber, protein, calcium, manganese, magnesium, zinc, and B vitamins. And they have plant compounds that help to reduce inflammation, manage blood sugar, and lower high cholesterol levels. So sesame seeds are tasty in stir fries, pasta, smoothies, and you can also get sesame butter, which is called tahini. And you can have tahini savory or sweet. And if you're Jewish, you may, if you're Jewish, or if you're of Middle Eastern descent, you may have been given halva before, which is a treat, a confection that is sweetened. It can be sweetened with honey. It can be sweetened with sugar. It can have just tahini and flavors like vanilla or chocolate. It can also be coarse and have things like actual sesame seeds and sunflower seeds and pumpkin seeds and fruit in it. And it's a great way to get your sesame on. So we'll continue with food sources of leucine and lysine, or leucine and, let's see, we want to make sure you know how to get your leucine and your lysine, and we'll tell you about that next time we're on. So, but meanwhile, it is time for me to go. All right. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND, for 30 days after creation. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.